Hello and welcome to another episode, a weekly episode of Cut to Reveal. Yeah, so this is another episode for the week. How you doing, Peter?
Doing fine, thank you, Ricky.
Nervous laughter and clearing our throats aside. I'm Ricky. This is Peter. We're two editors. We live in different countries, but we still like editing and like films and a whole lot of other things. So
exactly. And that nervousness at the beginning, I think it comes from the wrong title of the first episode, you know? So if you're not aware, I mean, the first episode of the second season, right? So we've been away. We haven't been recording the episodes for quite some time. Yeah. And I uploaded the episodes and Ricky is usually doing the title and the description. But I didn't let him know that, like, it's Saturday, 11 a.m. It's supposed to come out at that time. So Ricky thought he has more time to do it. And then it came out with like a temp title that I had, which is like, what should be the title? We're back? And that's what came out to the world and to the first listeners. So if you're one of those who has seen this title, you're one of the lucky few. Because we changed it quite quickly, like a few hours after it went live. But yeah, it was fun. It was fine hiccup at the beginning of the second season.
Yeah, so now we need to figure out what we're going to call this episode.
Yeah, exactly. I guess it will come out as we start to talk about the points. I want to start with like a little bit of topic, not editing related. But I mean, you can argue that anything is editing related. I mean, you know, the way you spend your free time and you charge your batteries is also kind of important. So Ricky, I know that tomorrow you're leaving and you're going to disc golf tournament. Is that right?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that sport? Because I didn't know it even existed before you told me about it.
Sure. Real quick, it's essentially golf, but with, for lack of a better term, frisbees, so discs. And then you might, if you, especially in the States, but you see more of it here in Europe also, but there'll be like a basket made of metal with like chains and whatever, positioned. Usually they're around like parks or, strangely enough, like, industrial areas, like corporate, campuses and whatever, where you see a lot of like big business buildings and whatever, especially in like Colorado and whatever. But anyway, it's pretty big. And it's really fun. It's like I said, it's just like regular golf. This isn't a very good description, but it's essentially regular golf. So, you know, you're throwing a disc as close as you can to the basket, which is the pin. And there are tons of rules and, you have different, the discs are shaped a little bit different than regular frisbees. They're smaller. They have different weights. They have different shapes. So you have like a disc that is a little bit more sleek that would be a driver because it would fly farther, and you have like a mid-range disc which looks, you know, as you get closer to the basket you don't need the disc to fly as far, so the discs become more rounded and become more similar to like what you think of when you think of like a frisbee. I just got into going to my brother played, and so that's how I my younger brother plays, and so that's how I got involved in it, and it's just kind of like something to do, like hiking around with a reason. And so, because, you know, you're on these courses and it's like kilometers and miles sometimes to get through the whole 18 holes and whatnot. But recently, last year, I started playing tournaments, and tournaments are, there's a very strong community in disc golf in general. I've never played a tournament in the States, but I started playing here, and we're going to a tournament up at Belgium tomorrow. And a lot of the times that I've played tournaments have been in Belgium, and they have a very good young scene, so to speak, where they just started getting into it and started having tournaments and whatnot. And so everybody's really excited about it. And there's a really cool sense of community and camaraderie where you just kind of see people all the time at these tournaments. And it's like, oh, hey, how you doing? You catch up with them and whatnot. For those, I don't know, I grew up in the punk rock scene. So that was a big part of like my teenage years and early 20s, and so there's a big community of that where you'd go to shows, concerts and stuff, and you'd see like the same people, and that's the only time you'd ever see them would be at concerts. And I get that same feeling from going to these disc golf tournaments where you just see all these weird people that you only see at this specific spot, and it's like a camaraderie, everybody's there to do the same thing. It's pretty positive, there's no attitudes and whatever, and if people do have an attitude, then you've got friends that are going to back you up in case, you know, something happens. It's, I'm making it sound more dangerous than it is, but it's the camaraderie of that type of community at going to that thing and just kind of having a good time. Like nobody's there, nobody's pro. There's better people than other people in that regard, but it's just something to do and fun. And, you know, you know, driving to a different place with your friends just to have like a good weekend of whatnot. So
the community protects itself from douchebags, basically.
It can. I mean, not to say that there aren't douchebags in any community, but it's interesting with disc golf, like through the years, it's kind of reached, it's getting more and more popular. And like you can watch like professional disc golf tournaments on YouTube and, you know, other, there's like similar to baseball, there's like an A tier, like the majors, and then there's B tier and C tier with like different players and whatever. I mean, it's an individual sport, but so it's really interesting. And in that sense, you get a lot of coverage and people editing, and there's documentaries about crazy things that happen within, you know, tournaments and whatever. So there is an editing aspect to it and kind of a filmmaking aspect to it. But yeah, it's blowing up. The amount of tutorials and, like I said, awareness videos that you can find online and tournament footage on YouTube is kind of, it's overwhelming. But yeah, so that's what I'm doing this weekend, is going driving up with a friend and picking up a friend at the Brussels airport, and then we're going to be out at a course for 2 days. It's a 2-day tournament. So
amazing, man. Amazing. Bring a trophy back.
I'll try. I mean, the field is stacked, and there's, you know, there's 90 people that are competing, and given they're all going to be separated into different categories and, like, you know, professional, amateur, you know, women, there's a teenage thing category and whatever. So there's going to be a lot of us. I'm hoping that I just don't come in dead last. That's always my goal. And just to be able to like throw good and have a good time, try not to get too frustrated when things don't go my way. But
I get it, man.
That's what I'm looking forward to. Are you doing anything good this weekend coming up?
Not really. Nothing specific. I have a friend coming by who recently moved back. He went to the seaside and spent like 2 years, even more, 4 years there. And he's coming back. He has came back. So, yeah, he's just visiting the family, which he hasn't done since he came back to the city. So, yeah. It will be good to have him around. Yeah, but I had quite an interesting event last week. I went to like a pre-premiere of a short film.
Okay.
Which is like a premiere, but really for like a closed circle of cast and crew, usually. In this case, it was kind of open. So to be honest, I was a little bit surprised because usually you can't have an open premiere if you're applying to festivals and stuff like that. But it seems like it's fine as well, what he has done, like what this guy has done for his short film and for this premiere. But yeah, I went there to see how he runs the thing, because I'm thinking about pre-premiering Yellow Ticket potentially as well. Although I will not risk, you know, just opening the door to anyone. But still, I wanted to see how he has done it to think about what I like about it, what I don't like, and what I would have done differently, stuff like that. So basically trying to learn from other people's mistakes, not to say that there were only mistakes, of course, there were good things as well. So from their success as well, that's what I was there for. It was fun. It was fun. I have some conclusions. I have some things that I liked. I have some things that I didn't like. So that's good. That's what I came with.
That's great.
Yeah.
For the listener who doesn't know, Yellow Ticket is Peter's short film that he directed, edited, and produced for the first time. Yeah. It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of a big deal. It's good.
By the way, there is official selection for short films for Cannes Film Festival is today, I think. They're announcing the lineup today. I have submitted there.
Yeah.
But I'm realistic. The chances are very low, extremely low. As far as I know, there are like 2,000 films submitted.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some limitations, actually, to what you can submit to Cannes. It has to be world premiere, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it has to be up to 15 minutes. So Yeah, and must have been produced in the last 12 months or something like that. So it's like very, very limited. Well, not very limited, but it's limited, right? So 2,000 submissions compared to Sundance, where you get like 10,000, something like that. But the thing is that Cannes selects only 14 short films, as far as I know. 14 short films out of those 2,000, right? So it's like less than 1%. So like, I'm not like fully myself, but still waiting for this to come out. Although I, as far as I know, festivals usually get in touch with their selected films before they announce the lineup. Yeah. So that's the first kind of, you know, sign that you can kind of have that you have not been selected. But still waiting and just curious to see, you know, who's there, who's there.
Yeah. How many other film fests did you submit to?
About 20. Yeah. Yeah. And I basically, you know, for some of them, I will hear in June, for two of them in May. But for most, I will hear back in September and October, I think. So it's a long time just waiting, right? Which is frustrating again. I think I've mentioned before. So yeah. I'm ready to show it to the world, but the world is not ready to see it yet, I guess, because of that limitation that some festivals have with premiering film and stuff like that. But I posted a trailer to my Instagram recently. So if you're curious to see the trailer, check out my Instagram, which comes with just my name, or there will be the link in the description to the podcast. That's what I can post for now.
Yeah, we shared it on the CTR Instagram, or I did as well. Film festivals are what my story about that is having released Holding These Moments in 2020, and we, you know, it was the middle of the pandemic, and so we weren't, our dream other than like finishing it and putting it out was to, my dream at least, was to like see it in a theater, which I haven't been able to see. I know that we had a couple kind of premieres in the States where it showed and whatever, just so that people could see it, and it went over pretty well. But yeah, I've submitted to so many film festivals, but you know, there's a limitation. Like you said, you can only, it has to be done within the 12 months or whatever. They're like, anything before 2020 can't be put in, or anything before 2023 can't be put in. So it kind of limits, you know, which makes sense. These places, they only want like new work. They don't want to keep on showing the same stuff over and over again.
Obviously, yeah. It has to be the limit. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's just easier to get into a lot of like online film festivals, which I don't know if the pandemic was the reason for that, but a lot of the stuff that I submitted to, they're a little bit cheaper. And, you know, for whatever reason, there's a submission platform called Film Freeway. That a whole bunch of film festivals, like essentially all the film festivals,
it's
will go
and you can just basically at this point.
yeah,
like 99% of festivals use Film Freeway.
Yeah,
selected few won't. Like for example, Cannes has their own platform, and I submitted to another one in Switzerland, which doesn't use Film Freeway. But other than that, every other festival goes through Film Freeway.
Yeah, and so once you submit to a specific kind of festival, then all the other festivals that are just like that will just inundate you. You'll just get emails from them, and a lot of them are online or whatever. And anyway, long story short is that I'm still submitting to film festivals, and you know, you're still, it's kind of the thing where it's like, okay, I submitted this stuff 6 months ago to like a handful of different film festivals, and then you start hearing like, oh, you got picked, judging status has changed, and you get either selected or nominated or whatever, and then everybody's like, oh my God, you guys are doing so great. How did you do it? And it's just like, well, you just submit and then hopefully they pick your stuff. And it's like, that's it. So lately, I've been getting a lot of emails about like submission statuses. And so we've been selected, and it's a pretty good run in regards to like, we've been nominated and selected by numerous film festivals. A lot of them are smaller, but yeah, it's interesting. Makes you feel good and whatever, but yeah,
I'm actually a bit surprised that you can still submit.
Yeah, a lot of these film festivals are kind of, if there was an A, B, and C tier, these would probably be like C tier Some of them are just starting out. They're like in their first year. And a lot of them are online film festivals.
Okay, so they don't have some of those them are just, strict limitations, basically.
Right. There's no, these are not, to be honest, a lot of them aren't really like film festivals. They're like award fests.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. You'd submit and then somebody looks at it and then you get an award, like you were selected. Or sometimes it'll be like, you know, you've gotten to the finals or the semifinals or the, you know, whatever. And so it's kind of a competition. And then maybe you get to the end and then you just get an award. So some of these places would, yeah, I don't know. It's a lot of those smaller fests and award ceremonies are like, we'll take whatever because we want, you know, we want submissions and whatnot.
Copy that.
And some of them I'm like, I think that this is just way for people to get money. Like, I don't know. I'm like, I just paid like $20. And then I got selected. So is that because I just paid the $20 because it's a good film? You know, I think holding these moments is good, but
it's good.
Some of them you're like, kind of, yeah, you're kind of like, I feel like I'm wary. I don't know if I'm shit talking or whatnot, but it's some of these things are like interesting where like this website looks terrible. I'm not going to submit to this and whatnot.
I know what you mean. Festivals are business these days. So you have to be... you have to be careful how you approach them, I think. For me right now, my strategy is that I applied to quite good festivals, to be fair. Mm-hmm. Most of them are Academy nominated. Not nominated, but basically they give you opportunity to be nominated for Academy Awards if you win the festival.
Right.
And those are very... It's very hard to get to one of those because the mm-hmm. There are so many submissions for each year, right?
Right.
So it's hard to get to those, but if you get to those, it's kind of good, right? So my strategy for now is try those higher tier festivals first.
Mm-hmm.
But then if it doesn't work out, I either go with those festivals that are just starting out. And I think that then it's a matter of just trying to figure out which one of those are actually serious about what they're doing.
Yeah.
Or the other way I could choose is just ignore festivals altogether if I don't get to one of those that I think would be very good to, you know, to get to. I mean, I will probably still submit to some smaller festivals in Poland in the worst case scenario, just to, you know, have this experience of watching it with other people. I think festival submission strategy is something you have to think about quite early on, I think.
Sure.
So in your case, it's good to know that there are festivals that you will accept the film, even though it's been finished like 3 or 4 years ago. You can still like try to get more eyeballs on it, I guess. That's attention. And yeah, it's good.
Yeah, and then you get like the accolades and it makes you feel good. So like if I was to put out a one sheet of holding these moments, like we'd have so many the laurels all over it for all of our selections, which is cool. I mean, it's always nice to see that. And it kind of adds a legitimacy to us as filmmakers. But in regards to how the strategy that we would do it next time, we submitted to like South by Southwest, but it's just like Cannes. I mean, there's like thousands of submissions and you're like, okay. And it's a business thing. Like people might not like me saying this, but their focus is for them to get people into South by Southwest. And so it's a business thing. Like how, if you're going to have something, what's the X factor? Like, you know, we were talking with a friend of ours to be like, okay, she worked for Slam, Slam Dance for a long time. And she's like, you got to have like almost like a gimmick. Like, okay, what are you going to have? Are you going to have the band come up and play? Are they going to play? And then you show the film and stuff. Like, what's the draw other than your film that you're going to get people that's going to set your, you know, the experience of seeing this film apart from all the other people that are showing up or all the other films and whatnot. So that's, you know, it's exhausting. There's so much to do. You can't just like, it's not just as simple as like, I want to make a film and I'm going to put it out and hopefully people will see it. It's like, okay, if you really want to take it seriously and take, you know, things to the next level, then you have to. There's a business aspect of it aside from the art.
At the same time, like, you know, filmmaking is exhausting. It's just the fact. You have to embrace it if you want to get your hands wet. and you have to have some kind of strategy, I guess, because you got to find a way to stand out somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so many films. Again, like Sundance has like 10,000 submissions or something like that each year, pretty much, right? Yeah. So, you know, the chances are not high.
It's an uphill battle.
Yeah.
But that's not why we do it. We do it because we love it.
Okay. Anyway, I think we'll talk about this more in the future when Yellow Ticket gets selected to one of those big festivals.
Yeah. To be continued.
To be continued. Yeah. Or we're here back from me in a year with just the feeling of sour attitude and the hatred to festivals. And so we'll see which one of those it will be. Ricky, you got another job. Tell me about it.
Oh, yeah. So as it rains, it pours. I got a job a couple of weeks ago because I was like, I need work. And then a friend of mine came forward and was like, hey, I got this job. Are you interested? And I needed the money. And I was like, yes. And then I started working on it and I'm already overwhelmed with work. And I was like, why did I take this job? But it's almost done. And then somebody else reached out to me and was like, hey, we got this job. Do you want to work? And I was like, yes, I do, because I need the money. And then I'm already regretting it. But I know it's with good people, so it'll be fine. But I'm very appreciative and grateful that that my luck is like this, that this happens. But the one project that I'm wrapping up soon is kind of a corporate project, and this one is more docu-style, like sports stuff, similar to like a lot of the stuff that I was doing. For those of you who don't know, I don't even know we were talking about it. One of the reasons why it took us so long to do more episodes is that I was working a lot. We were very busy with life and whatnot. And one of the things I was doing is working for cutting videos for the University of Connecticut, their sports YouTube channel, like the Huskies. And so that client came back with another episode that they needed somebody for because their usual editor was on vacation or something. So yeah, when I finish it, I'll let you guys know, and then I'll send you a link when it's up. But that's what I'm going to be doing now, or that's what I'll be doing at the end of the month. It'll start, and it'll just be like maybe 10 days. So
cool. Good stuff.
Actually, this is not a good segue. I was just going to say, so this time around, you're hearing our voices, but we're not using Adobe Podcast this time around. We're using Riverside, which is who we would use before. So Peter, you were the guy. So Peter, tell us about because you were basically setting up the podcast with Adobe and then inviting me on as a guest, which is super from the perspective of where I was sitting and seeing the user experience is very, very basic, very minimal. Like it's just an icon with like two buttons. It's like turn your mic on and turn your mic off and like settings. But as you were the host, what kind of other bells and whistles, and what is your first impression of the Adobe Podcast setup?
So the reason we're using Riverside is basically because I signed up for Riverside again because I needed to run the Premiere Pro PowerPlay workshop. That's the main reason.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, the experience there isn't great just yet. So
yeah.
You might have remembered from the previous episode that I've mentioned that if you won't hear any of those like and filler words, basically that it means there is a feature to remove those in Adobe Podcast, and you can't hear those, but there isn't this feature. This feature isn't there. I still brought it to Premiere and removed all of the filler words in Premiere, which does this very quickly these days because of the transcription feature, right? But also in Premiere, you can use the enhance audio feature with a slider. So basically you have a slider where you mix how much of it is applied and how much is the original audio. And in Adobe Podcast, you just have a switch. So it's either on or off, and you can manipulate how much it's applying this effect. And it was overdoing it so much that I couldn't do it out of Adobe Podcast. Basically, I had to bring it back to Premiere. Not back, but bring it to Premiere. You know what I mean? So I think that it's a good start because the transcription it gave us right after I stopped the recording basically was great.
Oh wow!
Like seriously, yeah. So that's good stuff. Although Riverside can do this type of thing as well these days, but I think it's a stepping in the good in good direction basically. But for now, in this beta version, it's not there yet to be really useful. We'll probably use it again at some point. So.
Is Adobe Podcast going to be part of the Creative Cloud?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's supposed to be. By the way, another big news this week is generative, how do you call it? Like basically generating videos inside of Premiere. Have you seen the NAB news?
Oh, no, I haven't. I
haven't?
I have not looked at anything
no
at NAB,
way.
Unfortunately.
No way. It's hard to miss it, actually.
I've been working. I've been buried under editing.
Okay, that explains the thing. Yeah. Yeah. So basically, they showed that they're working on a version of Premiere where you can extend a clip and it will AI generate the rest of it. You can select a section of a timeline and just write the prompt of what video is supposed to be there. And basically, it uses like OpenAI, I guess, and their Firefly engine to open night, I guess, to analyze what it's about, and then Firefly engine to generate the video, right? And it's impressive when you look at the promos. But for me right now, you know, I used Firefly actually for generating images before. And I wasn't that impressed, to be honest. I wasn't impressed with DALL-E, for example, either, with their image generation approach. It's good when you want just something fun, but if you want something very specific, it won't listen. It won't apply the changes you want it to apply and stuff like that. But again, like, it doesn't mean it's not going to work. It probably means that it's not going to work that well just yet. And it might work very well in some cases, in some scenarios. You know, the thing is scary. The Sora from OpenAI is kind of scary.
Yeah.
It will probably take some time before it's really good and it really replaces people. But although, yeah, I mean, Marcus Brownlee made a video about Sora, which I think was, I mean, his stuff is usually insightful. And yeah, he made a good point that for like the drone footage that they showed, it was like almost perfect. Like you couldn't ask for anything better, really. So in some cases, it will probably replace people right away. Yeah, but it's both scary to see it coming to Premiere and exciting as well. I don't know if you ever used image generation in Photoshop. But you have it in Photoshop for some time. Adobe has it in Photoshop for some time right now. And I actually used it for two occasions for a client. Yeah, pretty much. Like, not really. Like, I don't want to go into details, but basically, you know, for someone, right? I did it for someone. And it worked very well, very well. So it's a thing. It's a thing. It will be a thing very soon. You have to embrace it to some extent.
No, I agree. I mean, compared to other people, compared to you, I feel like I'm low tech in regards to not knowing. I don't have my hand on the pulse of like, oh, this is the newest thing coming out and this is the new tech and you should be aware of this because how I'm doing things isn't broken and it's working. And so it's not like I need these other things, like the AI and whatever. And I can understand the benefits to some of those things. And then other stuff, I'm like, okay, why are we doing this? Like, was there such a great need that they're like, this is what the industry is screaming for, and that's why we have brought in these new bells and whistles? Or is it just like, hey, what if we did this? Like, wouldn't it be cool if we had this? And then, you know, I feel like nowadays we are, and I hate to get into this, like, oh, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it. But I feel like there's a certain point where it's like, okay, we're kind of opening Pandora's box here. We're like, yeah, that would be cool to see. And then we see it. And then it's just like, oh no, it's gotten away from us. And now it's ruined our lives. And well, the only people we have to blame for it is ourselves. So like you said, that's kind of is what makes it scary. But I guess it goes back to my first question is just like, was there such a need that we're like, okay, we need to have this tool of AI so that, oh, we've got this one thing and we need to put, you know, we need to generate something new here. And that's why, because so many editors within the industry were like, I need this or else it won't work and blah, blah, blah. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, it's both. It's both. I think it is gimmick to some extent. It's just like a marketing trick because it's very easy to market anything AI related these days. And especially if it makes people like, wow, right? Then you've got like a good selling point and good marketing. I mean, even my friend who uses Resolve, he used to use Sony Vegas to edit. He switched to Resolve like a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But when he saw that video from Adobe, he was like, oh my goodness, I might consider switching to Premiere now. And I said, like, calm down. It's probably gonna, you know, it's probably gonna be in Resolve very soon as well. They're chasing each other over this. So don't get too excited. But you know, it shows that like people are excited about this and it's kind of a big deal, but also brings the question that you just posted, which is like, are they doing it really for good reasons, or is it just like a marketing strategy that they have? I think it's both, to be honest. I think it's both. Some examples that they show, like for example, there is like a briefcase with diamonds in it, right? And they select the inside of the briefcase and basically write something like, make it full of diamonds instead of just a few in there, right? And it adds the diamonds and, you know, and they move as the camera moves. It's supposed to save you time. And instead of going to After Effects and having to know how to do it and then spending like 3 hours to do it, you can basically do it in like 2 minutes sitting and not knowing what's happening. But at the same time, you don't have that much control over it. It's not easy to decide, like, you know, whether it's going to be super useful or just somewhat useful sometimes.
Yeah, I think that somebody, a friend of mine, had messaged me like the sorry thing and was like, there goes content creators and editors, like you're losing your jobs. And I was like, I don't know about that. I was like, I don't think that this may, you know, maybe people will look at this in 20 years and be like, you're dumb. But I don't think that it's really going to take over the market. I think it's a tool. And I think that it is a tool that people will become good with and they'll use it. But because of how deep, you know, like programs like Resolve and Premiere are, that you will be able to still do the things without having to do any of that stuff. Like there are going to be people who work on this stuff, editors and content creators, that don't need to rely on that and will be able to work around it. It's not like AI is like forcing us to use it. It's just another tool within the toolbox. And some people will be like, this is my go-to, and other people won't. And so in the same way that like people buy fast food and like fast food, you also have at the same time people who like to make their own food, and there's like a big scene for that. And so I don't think that AI is going to basically erase a whole field of people. And I think in regards to Hollywood and filmmaking, like that industry is too big and there are too many people that know that their jobs and lives are at stake, that if AI takes control, that it's going to, you know, ruin it. And so people are going to push back against it.
Yeah, although, you know, writers push back on it.
Yeah,
right?
No, that's what I mean. Like they're pushing back on it.
The reality is it has the effect on them already. And it will be the same with us, I think, to some extent. For example, you know, there will be just a kid writing prompts on his computer, generating a story. And by the way, that will apply his films to festivals and will get in. And it's also a question like, is it really worth that wrong? Because like, if he's telling a story, then he's just making what he's supposed to do if he would do it in a traditional way. So yeah, it's another tool. It's another tool in our toolkit of storytelling. That's what I'm thinking. But you know, the thing that I have in my mind anytime I see these AI related news that are breaking news, right? But which, by the way, the new one is Udio. I don't know if you ever heard about this. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it's like UDIO, and it's basically for generating music, right? And there is an example of, for example, Dune, the Broadway musical, and it like spills out the song, the musical, Broadway musical, with like singing about the characters, and it's like it's really good, seriously, really, really good, surprisingly good, I would say. But again, so does Sora mean that there won't be any content creators and filmmakers anymore? Does Yudio mean that that we won't have any musicians anymore? Of course not, because the reality is that people want to see other people's create. They want to consume content created by other people, not by computers. And there will be some kind of, I mean, I'm not saying that there won't be any part of the market, but it still probably will, even if you generate things using AI, you will probably still have your name attached to it. And so again, that comes back to that aspect of this is just another tool. It will not just run by itself. But it's a transition that is coming very soon, and I think we have to be ready for it. It's important to think about, like, you know, the replications of those tools.
Yeah, I mean, my point was that it's not going to, like you had just said, I would just be repeating what you said, like, it's not going to saturate the market where everybody's going to be like, oh, only AI stuff is what you see and hear these days. It's like everybody will have a job. Maybe some people will lose it, and if anything, what it made me think of is, like, you had brought up the idea of there are people who everybody can edit in the same way that everybody can read and everybody can write, but then there's people that are really good at it, and those are the people that stand out. So just because you can, like, I can write, but doesn't mean I can write a novel and that makes me an author. But people will have these skills, and I think that with AI, it'll enable more people to do, like, jumping all over the place here, but in the same sense of, like, the only way an author in the past could put out a book was to get with a publishing house. Now somebody can write a book and they can just put it up on Amazon and just start publishing it themselves and go to, like, a, you know, pay as you go type of place where they just produce on demand. And so you don't need to have the backing of, like, Schuster and Schuster or, you know, Random House or whatever publishing company to, like, put out books. And I think that AI will enable some people to do that. Like you said, they'll write a story and then they'll have something and then they can, you know, have a little bit of money coming their way, but it doesn't take out all the other people that are in an industry and working on it and stuff. And like you said, it's just going to be a tool that people will have to adapt to and figure out how they can use it and benefit from it.
Amen.
Amen. Moving on. What's the next thing we're talking about?
I don't know. TV shows, films, movies. I think we're in the deep end right now.
We're at the deep end. <I'm kidding. laughs> So we have a list of themes that we want to talk about. And Peter had brought up podcasts about expanding on episodes of TV shows and probably movies as well. But I know I've seen it more on TV shows.
No, I wanted to specifically talk about TV shows, TV show related podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now I'm watching Shogun.
Oh, yeah.
Which is on Disney, right? Plus. And it's really good. It's really good. I like it. And I discovered that they have the podcast. And I think it's just I think it's so good to have a podcast to a show like that, that explains some stuff that goes into more detail. Sometimes you're discovering stuff that you haven't discovered for yourself, because those episodes tend to be a little bit complicated sometimes. It's like a Shogun is basically like, I don't know how to call it, but it's like a political thriller, to some extent at least, because it has this, like, political aspect to it, and, like, people playing games, you know, with their lives almost, right? So not almost, like, exactly what that's what exactly what they're doing in a way. So it gets complicated sometimes, and it's great to have those episodes where you can reflect again on what you just saw. But the first TV show that I have seen doing it was Chernobyl, which again had, like, an episode of podcast for each episode of the series. And they were fact-checking, basically. And, like, Craig Mazur, the writer, the creator, he was basically saying, like, what's exactly the way it happened in real life, what was a little bit dramatized, where they merged a few characters into one, you know, stuff like that, right? And it's extremely interesting to hear about this stuff. So for Shogun, it's quite similar, where they, like, talk about what it was like in Japan in early 17th century, because basically it happens in year 1600. That's the year the action is going on. And there are some flashbacks as well, so even earlier, right? 16th century, basically. And they're bringing those experts that are talking about this, you know, Japan in that
the
time.
Like feudal Japan.
Yeah, but also about, they're also bringing in actors, and they're bringing in directors of those episodes, and they discuss things, and I find it super interesting. So, yeah, just wanted to talk about this. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I know that HBO does a lot. I've seen HBO do that with a lot of their shows. I don't know if they did it with Game of Thrones. I definitely know they did it with Chernobyl and some other stuff that I've seen, and I can't remember what it is now. Anyway, but yeah, I think that they're not just with the podcast, but I think Walking Dead did it. There was a Talking Dead after that show, which was more like a talk show, but essentially it's the same thing. People coming in, actors talking about, you know, what the episode was like. And I feel like there wasn't one for The Mandalorian, but I saw the first season of The Mandalorian and I didn't care. It's like, I watched it because I was like, this is, a lot of my friends are watching it and it's cool. I was like, this is, I mean, it's good. You know, it's essentially a space Western, and I like space Westerns. And the only thing that got me invested in it was watching the behind the scenes stuff where they showed you how they essentially made the sausage. And then they did with season two. They also did with season one, but with season two, they also did like a round table talking with the actors and the directors. And that is what made me essentially, I hate saying this, but fall in love with The Mandalorian. Like up until that point, like knowing what was put into it made me more invested in seeing this series and watching it and like just appreciating how the sound was made and, you know, the isn't it the volume or the vault or whatever that they do, all that crazy, you know, when they're filming on location, you're like, oh, they're in the middle of a desert, but they're not. They're actually in like a room full of the screens and whatnot.
Visual production,
Yeah, like all of those things, like hearing from the actors and hearing from the directors just made me more invested in it. And so, yeah, listening to those podcasts and those kind of backstory tales, like even most recently, we watched the documentaries on the Lord of the Rings movies. And it's like, you know, stuff that you don't know about, like, you know, just production stories about crazy stuff that happens, but then just how they made everything and just like, it just kind of blows you away. It's really interesting stuff. And, you know, especially with Shogun, which I believe is a remake that they had. It was a series that they did in the 80s. And I think it's also a book. Is that right, too?
Yes, exactly. It's based on the book, yeah. And the book is based on real events as well. So it's based. It's not exactly describing the real events, but it's based on real events and real characters.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when the first series came out, when it was on. It was a limited series on TV. I concur that listening to that stuff like makes you just so much more invested in the way that they make these films and these TV shows and whatnot. It's pretty awesome, I think. It's not something that we ever had before in regards to film and TV.
Yeah, there's a DVD extra to some extent, but it's fun. It's fun, especially for film geeks like us.
Speaking of which, what did you, other than Shogun, what else have you been watching this week?
Oh, I have to check. But mostly Shogun. I'm not sure if I have seen anything else.
We watched that movie Bottoms, which is like a quirky, vulgar comedy. I forgot her name. Let me look it up so that I'm not talking.
Yeah, we've seen that actress. First of all, it's an actress from The Bear, right? But it's also another actress that played one of the characters in a short film of Appendage.
Rachel Sennott, I hope I'm pronouncing that correct, was the girl in the short film Appendage, which if you've been listening to our podcast, you know that we talked to the editor, Alex Vermillion. And so he was the one that edited the short film Appendage. And then they released a feature
which he edited as well.
He edited as well, him and his wife, also the director of that film. And then, I think the girl from The Bear was Ayo Edebiri.
Exactly.
Edebiri?
That's her.
Edebiri. Exactly. Yeah. And so it's funny you should mention that because we just finished watching The Bear season one yesterday.
Good for you.
It was good. We had watched the first episode months ago, my wife and I, and we were like, this is good. And then just kind of like stopped watching it for whatever reason. And we returned to it because we're like, what are we going to watch? You know, because we usually eat and watch something. And so we turned that on. But we're watching it on free Hulu, and free Hulu, not Hulu Premium, has all the commercials. So it's like they show like 2 minutes and then a commercial comes on for another 2 minutes. You're like, oh my God, this sucks. My wife hates it. So we're going to try to get, upgrade for the second
season, man.
Yeah, either that. But we're also big fans of Welcome to Wrexham, which is that soccer reality show about Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds. They bought a Welsh football team a few years ago, and they invested in it. And they're like, essentially, they're like, this is a Welsh soccer team. It's one of the oldest in the country, and they're not doing very good. And we just want to invest in it because it's kind of like an underdog story. And Rob McElhenney's from Philadelphia, and he like really identified with this town and these people and whatever. And so their idea was like, we want to improve the town, but also hopefully we can, you know, a lot of the heart of the town is based around this soccer team, the football team. And they're like, if we can get good people in there and essentially, you know, get them on a winning streak and whatever, that'll bring people's spirits up, and that will bring money to the town and whatever. And essentially that's what happened. You know, because of how the football leagues are in Europe and whatnot, like the worst teams go down a league. So I had mentioned before the A, like major leagues, double, you know, whatever. So like they were in probably one of the lower leagues and they used to be in the Premier League, but they were down like five leagues. So they're like almost at the point where it was just like a bar league. Probably better than that. But anyway, so every time that they move up a league, so if they were in the National League and they moved up to League Two, then they would get more money, which would help them improve the grounds. And then the players would get more money, and then it would bring more people to the games. And, you know, all a rising tide lifts all boats, essentially. And so that's what they set out to do. And they did it. You know, it wasn't like these two movie stars came in and they just started pouring money into everything. They had an actual business and they had to make it. And so, but it was on the team being good and winning and stuff. And so they just, in the first season, they got to the finals, but they ended up not winning. And so then they did the second season, they ended up getting out of the National League into League Two. And then this year, they actually got out of League Two, and they're going to be in League One next year. And every time they go up a league, they get more money. And because of that, it basically made the town of Wrexham, like, which was an old steel town, like kind of rejuvenated the economy and brought people back in and stuff. And so it's really good. I don't really like reality shows, and this is more like a docu style, but it's really, really good. It kind of makes you care about these people because it gives you behind the scenes in the same way that we had talked about, like the podcast stuff, where it shows you how they're making it. But in this sense, it's like how a football team becomes, like, this is stuff that you don't even think about, like what a manager does and what an owner does and like all the money that goes into it. And like realizing like, oh yeah, despite Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney like having millions of dollars, they're also sinking millions and millions of dollars into this team that if they don't win, it just becomes like a black hole. And like if they can't, they have to win, like it has to be a winning team or else they don't make their money back and they don't break even. So it's very endearing. I highly recommend it if you're into that type of like storyline and those type of things. But anyway, that was a long plug for Welcome to Wrexham. We are not sponsored by them or Hulu, but just a recommendation. So
I don't think we have anything to add today. So we'll see each other next week, which, by the way, maybe we'll talk about Harry Potter series, TV series coming to Max next week. So
talk about contention amongst fans.
Let's see. I think it could be one of the talking points for the future episode. Okay. Anyway, thank you for listening, and till the next one.
Have a good day, everybody. You know how to get in contact with us. We got Instagram, and there's information within the episode descriptions of all our podcasts. Until next time, see you next week. Take care.